Today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, he is 90 years old, and he still drives from Orange Cove to L.A. and back twice a week to sell all the great produce he grows. He wouldn't be doing that if he hadn't survived World War II and a tragic incident of friendly fire that killed three of his crewmates.
They were just like your brother, you know, and it was sad.
Catch this veteran story today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
As Americans, we enjoy many freedoms. Among them are the freedom to vote, to worship, and to speak our mind. These freedoms have long been protected by the men and women of our armed forces and their families that supported them. For more than 15 years, Humana has made a commitment to our veteran community. That commitment continues today with the introduction of the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans and their families. In developing this product, we listened to more than 10,000 veterans. With their input and our 50 years of expertise in the healthcare industry, we developed an affordable dental plan that also includes discounts on vision, hearing, retail prescription drugs, and more. We are proud to offer this plan to our veterans and their families right here in Fresno and throughout the country. We are also proud to announce that Humana is now the 2012 exclusive healthcare partner for the MVETS. Find out more about the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans. Call our Fresno office, 559-221-2522, 559-221-2522.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday on KMJ. Maybe you hear us on the booming 50,000-watt signal of News Talk 580, maybe on the FM side at 105.9, or maybe you hear us online at kmjnow.com anytime, anywhere around the world. And maybe if you've attended some farmers markets in Southern California, you've run into a guy from the San Joaquin Valley selling his grapes, his Armenian cucumbers, maybe his pluots or his quinces. 90-year-old Harry Nicholas of Orange Cove, California, our guest today. He's got quite a story from World War II. But I want to know, what keeps you going to these farmers markets? You're 90 years old and you still drive all the way down to Southern California every single week?
Yes, I do. And I enjoy doing it. It's no problem. I just happy what I do.
And, you know, there's been a big buzz the last few months, ever since the Super Bowl, when they ran that big commercial that said, "Thank a farmer," used Paul Harvey's old monologue and said, "Thank a farmer." You are that farmer, and you have been your whole life, huh?
Yes, I have. Yes.
Is there one thing you've grown that you've taken the most pride in or maybe gotten the best response to?
Kiwis.
Yeah?
Yes. I planted an orchard here in 1971, and I went to New Zealand to see how they did it over there, and I came here and started doing it the same way they were doing it. Mm-hmm. And I still got the orchard.
So is there a secret there that you're not allowed to tell us? Is that what you're saying?
No, there's no secret. Whatever's in the open, I just tell it.
Uh-huh. And how long are you going to keep doing this, driving all the way to Los Angeles every week?
Well, I'm happy with myself. I can still see. I can still drive. My mind's okay. And I just love what I do and being with people. And I enjoy that.
And I understand you've developed quite the reputation at these farmers markets for what you wear on your head.
All kind of hats, different colors, makes. Uh-huh. And they all know me because sometimes I wear a purple hat, a pink hat. So it's just fun.
I know you weren't wearing those kind of hats in the Navy. They had their own hat they wanted you to wear. Let's start before that. You were born here about a half mile from where you live, out on the east side of the valley in Orange Cove. One of eight children, and your parents came here from Lebanon, right?
Yes, they got here about 1910. They landed in New York, and they ended up in Oakland and Santa Rosa, and then they came here to Reedley in Orange Cove area about 1920. And I was born here in 1922 on the farm where I live now.
And I guess you grew up knowing that farming was going to be what you did, huh?
Yes, oh yeah. Uh-huh. When I got out of the service, I came back. And my dad said, "Well, you want to farm with me on a ranch, or you want to be like your brother?" They all took off. I said, "Well, I ain't got nothing to do. I'll just stay here." So I stayed here.
Well, and that by that time, you had a wife, and you were ready to raise your family and all that, too. But let's start before that. You grow up here. You finish school. December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about that? How did you find out that we were under attack?
Back in Oranges in Reedley.
Yeah.
And I heard about the news then, and I couldn't believe it, what had happened. It was on a Sunday morning, yeah.
Did you have any inkling that this would mean you would end up in the service?
No, I didn't. I didn't realize that. And then October came by of that year, I joined the Navy. I was 20 years old.
Were you drafted or did you sign up on your own?
Oh, I signed up on my own, yeah.
Why did you decide to do that?
I didn't want to go in the Army. It'd be a belly scratcher going under fences and all that. So I wanted to go in the Coast Guard. And the guy said, oh, you have to be 6 foot tall. I said, why is that? He said, well, in case the ship sunk, I wouldn't drown. I couldn't get in there. So.
So you knew that if you didn't sign up, you probably would be drafted, and you wanted to control your own destiny.
Yes.
But they didn't tell you that if you served in the Navy and got on PT boats, your own airplanes were going to be shooting at you.
No, I didn't know that.
That's what ended up happening. But before that, tell me what it was like to join the Navy and to go through the training you went through.
Well, I went to training up at Farragut, Idaho. From there, I went to school in Ames, Iowa, learned about engines there. From there, I went to PT boats in Melville, Rhode Island. And that's where they went to school there. We had to learn about the radios, torpedoes, the guns, and all. There's only 11 men on the boat, and we had to know all about the other parts of the boat, what to do.
Right.
So we had to know a lot of that.
I know you had to know everybody's duty and how to perform it, but what was your specific assignment on your boat?
I was on one of the three engines I took care of, one Packard V12 engine, 1,500 horse each engine.
So you were a motor machinist mate? Is that the title they gave you?
Yeah, motor machinist mate, second class.
Did you ever look at that Packard V12 engine and say, boy, I'd like to take that home with me and put it in a truck or something?
We went back to Fall River, Massachusetts. There's two PT boats in the museum there. Yeah. We went there and we saw that. My kids saw that and they said, Daddy, we didn't know they were that small. I said, what do you mean small?
Yeah, for folks who don't know, and maybe they've heard of PT-109 and President Kennedy and all that, but how big was a PT boat?
80 feet long. They were in that fort. Torpedoes on there. They had a 40-millimeter, two twin 50s, and a 37, and little carbines we had also.
So did this seem kind of exciting to you, that you were going to be heading over and cruising around in one of these little boats?
Well, I don't know what it was. I just did what they told me to do. Uh-huh. And it turned out real nice. I enjoyed what happened, and I learned a lot, and I came home.
Yeah, amen. And, you know, I always like to talk to veterans about how different things would have been. I wouldn't be here if my grandfather didn't get home from World War II. For you, we wouldn't have this guy with the colorful hat at the farmer's market, but without the Navy, you never would have met your wife either, huh? You met her in San Diego?
Met her on the dance floor, yes.
You must have been quite the dancer.
Oh, I love dancing, yeah.
And when was that? When did you meet Gloria?
I met her in, 1944, I think.
Before you shipped out to the Pacific?
The second time, yeah.
Well, I know your kids and grandkids are thankful that it worked out that way. Tell me about what it was like to head overseas. Do you remember what you were thinking when you went overseas?
No, I just got on a ship, went where they took me. That's about it.
Was there any part of you that wondered if you were going to come home ever?
No. I always figured I was going to come home, yeah. Second time when I went out, they put me on a yard minesweeper out of old wooden hull, out of sweeping mines out of between Shanghai and Taiwan, Keelong there.
That's a pretty tense job, too. I want to talk to you about the PT boats, though, because you were involved in something in April of 1944. There's a lot been made in recent years when we have an incident of friendly fire. You know, the Pat Tillman story comes to mind. It's a big national story, and everyone makes a big deal about it. This happened a lot in World War II, and we never really heard too much about it. In general, how hard was it to tell who was on your side and who was the enemy?
I don't know.
Yeah. Generally, you knew who was who, huh?
Yeah, right. We knew who was enemy and who wasn't.
And what happened on April 29th when you guys were sent to rescue another PT boat?
We were out patrolling out of Rabaul, and we're on the way out of the lagoon there, and the boat following us, it hit a reef, and it got stuck on a reef. We're trying to take it off. Well, the tide was going down. We couldn't get it off. 7 o'clock in the morning, these two planes came over, made one circle, and they dived right at us. And I noticed it was a Corsair because I could tell by the wings on it. I said to myself, I was a loader on a 40 millimeter. You can see these shells coming at you and everything. We shot one down. And the other one took off, went back to Green Island where he was at, and said, there's Japanese gunboats up there. So by the time they got up there, the boat I was on was crippled up, so it was injured on there. And they're going back to Talosia there where our Hilo was there. That was our shipper. So we told them what happened. So they mailed out. They came out there with another boat. The rescue, the other one was on the reef there. About 11 o'clock that morning, a whole bunch of American planes came over there, and they came this. They shot down one more plane, and they killed about 10 or 11 other people there. They lost two boats there, and it was all malfunction about how the communication was.
And I've read some of the reports about this, and it said that your boat and these other boats thought the planes coming at them were probably Japanese, but you're saying you recognized them because of that unique bend in the wing of the F-4U.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
But they're shooting at you guys.
They were shooting at us, yeah. They came in at us from the sun side. We were looking at the sun. We couldn't see them very good.
What does that feel like? What's going through your mind in that kind of situation?
I didn't think it would happen, but it did.
Did you think you were going to die?
No, not really.
You were wounded a little bit? Got a little scratch somewhere?
I got nicked on my leg. The doctor, the officer said, hey, Nick, you got nicked. They called me Nick for Nicholas. He said, Nick, you got nicked. I said, yes, I did.
But there were some other guys on your crew that got it a lot worse. You lost members of your crew there.
Three of them got killed. Three, yeah.
I know it's hard to see anybody killed in any circumstance, but did it feel different knowing that it was your own forces that killed your guys?
Boy, I was surprised, but I guess it could happen. It happened. Malfunction of what from one area to the other is different or something. I don't know what the deal was.
And so you guys were there initially trying to get this boat off the reef, but then you were gone when the planes came back the second time. And had you been there when they came back the second time, you might not be here with me.
That's right.
So in all the years since, I'm sure you've talked about it a few times. You've read books and articles about it. What's your best understanding of what went wrong there? Why did something like that happen?
I really don't understand what happened. I think these guys were 90-day wanderers, came here from the States, went there, and I guess they were...
The pilots, you mean?
The pilots, yeah. And I guess thought they were doing the right thing, but they didn't realize what was there. We had... big stars on top of the boat, the shoulders of the American planes, American boats and all that. They just made one circle, then came in.
And there was no way for you guys to communicate with them. You didn't have a radio that they would hear.
No communication at all.
And something like this had happened about a month earlier, I hear, too, right?
Australian planes did the same thing. That was out of New Guinea area, yeah.
So after this happens... You've lost three guys from your ship. There are other guys from other boats that are dead, and there are guys from these airplanes that are dead. Was that hard to get over for you? I mean, did that bug you for a while?
No, I was kind of happy that I was alive. You know, that I just things happened.
And they gave you guys leave after that?
Well, I went to Australia for 30 days on leave, came back, and they repaired the boat. I was on a PT-350, and two of us guys got back on the same boat, and then they had replacements come there.
The three guys from your boat that died, and you talked about there's only 11 men on this boat. I'm assuming you knew everyone pretty well. What do you remember about those three guys you lost that day?
They were well-liked, and they were just like your brother, you know. And it was sad, and they buried them there. I don't know what happened after that. If they reburied him somewhere else or what, I don't know.
And here you are. You're 90 years old. You're still running around your ranch here doing stuff. You're driving down to L.A. a couple times a week for farmers markets, still selling all your grapes and all your produce and wearing those hats and enjoying life at 90. In all these years, you ever think, that could have been me that died on that PT boat. What would those guys' lives be like?
No, I never thought about that.
I mean, it's pretty close to being that way, right?
Yes, it is, yeah. I'm just happy I'm around.
Mm-hmm. When you think about stuff like that, and I'm guessing that wasn't the only close call you had. Maybe you can tell me about some others, but did you feel like somebody was looking out for you?
Yeah, I think his dear Lord was looking out.
Hard to argue with that, especially when we see you going this strong at age 90. Maybe you're listening at home and you've bought produce from Harry over the years. If not, maybe you want to now. I want to talk to him more about his service in the Navy during World War II, but it's break time right now. 90-year-old Harry Nicholas of Orange Cove, California is our guest today. If you want to see what he looked like then or how good he's looking now, go to kmjnow.com and find the Hometown Heroes section. Or just pull up the photo album on Facebook. All you have to do is punch in Hometown Heroes on Facebook, and you'll get there. You'll see a bunch of photos of the rest of our veterans, too. We're back right after this with more of Hometown Heroes on KMJ. Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while. So next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas. It's me again, or maybe since I'm about to talk about a stellar educational institution, I should say it is I. I've had the privilege of witnessing a lot of remarkable victories over the years, from Fresno to Omaha to Washington, D.C., and a lot of places in between. I'm not saying I've seen it all, but I've been blessed to see some pretty special stuff. I don't think you'll ever guess the victory I was most astounded by this last week. It happened in San Francisco, but it had nothing to do with the Giants. The Warriors were impressive, but they haven't moved across the bay yet. No, this eye-popping win came from the Feather Online. Never heard of it? That's okay. You're not alone. And that's one of the reasons I'm telling you about it. Go to thefeather.com, thefeather.com, if you really want to experience it. The Feather Online is the daily online newspaper of Fresno Christian High School. And after competing against the top high school journalism programs in the country, The Feather just won Best of Show. It also won an online pacemaker, the high school and college equivalent of the Pulitzer. That's The Feather's second pacemaker in a row and the fifth time in 8 years. A couple months ago, The Feather picked up a digital gold crown at Columbia University in New York. It's a downright dynasty when it comes to high school journalism. And it's also the only place you'll find a detailed account of Tim Tebow's recent appearance in Fresno. Go to thefeather.com. That's thefeather.com to check it out. The Feather Online, part of Fresno Christian School's commitment to education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is 90-year-old Harry Nicholas of Orange Cove, California. Not only does he continue to farm, he continues to drive every week, twice a week, in fact, to Southern California to sell his great produce at farmers markets down there. I've got an article linked on our website at kmjnow.com. The Los Angeles Times, the LA Times, had a nice little write-up on Harry when he celebrated his 90th birthday last July. So check that out at kmjnow.com, and you'll find more photos of Harry on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We heard a bit about his experience as a motor machinist mate on PT-350. PT boats were an important weapon for the United States during World War II. In total, there were 531 of them during the war. 99 PT boats were lost during World War II. Harry served in the Pacific, and he shared his take with us on the events of April 29th, 1944. We just passed the 69th anniversary of this event. You heard him mention three members of his 11-man crew were killed that day. And to supplement that firsthand account that we received from Harry, here's a little more information that I also have linked at kmjnow.com. Let me read to you a little bit here. The majority of all friendly fire PT boat casualties during World War II occurred in the Southwest Pacific in two separate incidents occurring over the span of 1 month. The first on March 27, 1944, the second on April 29, 1944. PT-346, skippered by Lieutenant James Burke, was the rescue vessel in March and the victim in April. PT Boat Squadron 25 took the brunt of both incidents, which resulted in 22 men killed, including Burke, and 28 wounded. That Squadron 25, you'll see its insignia on Harry's wall out in Orange Cove. Continuing now, on March 27, 1944, PT-346 and PT-354 rescued the survivors of PT-353 and PT-121, which had been mistakenly destroyed during a mission off the coast of New Britain by five fighter planes under the command of the Royal Australian Air Force. Just over a month later, PT-346 itself became the victim of friendly fire. The morning of April 29, 1944, PT-346 was sent to the aid of PT-347, commanded by Lieutenant Robert J. Williams, and PT-350, skippered by Stanley L. Manning. PT-347 had become stuck on a reef during a night patrol to intercept enemy barges and destroy shore installations off the coast of Rabaul in Lasul Bay, located off the northwest corner of New Britain Island in New Guinea. The waters of the Pacific were not well charted, and during World War II, more PT boats were lost to reefs than to enemy fire. At 0700, so 7 in the morning, PT-350, that's Harry's boat, was attempting to dislodge PT-347 from the reef when two American Marine Corsair planes mistook the PT boats for Japanese gunboats and attacked. Taking heavy fire from the planes, PT-350 shot down one of the two attacking fighters, believing them to be Zeros. You heard Harry say, as he was loading that 40mm, he thought the plane did look like a Corsair because of that bowed wing. With three dead and four wounded and serious mechanical problems, PT-350 headed back to base. PT-347 remained stuck on the reef. Lieutenant Burke headed out with his crew and the base commander of the 25th Squadron, Lieutenant James Thompson, and Chief Pharmacist Mate First Class John Furkovich. They went to render medical aid. When PT-350 could not be boarded because of extensive damage, PT-346 headed out to PT-347 to provide assistance. PT-346 arrived at 12:30 and at 1400 was still attempting to dislodge PT-347 from the coral heads when planes reappeared. The Corsair plane from the morning run brought back an entire squadron of 21 planes, 4 Corsairs, 6 TBF Avenger torpedo bombers, 4 F-6F Hellcat fighters, and 8 SBD Dauntless dive bombers. Recognizing the planes as American and thinking they were the air cover he had ordered, the squadron commander ordered the men to keep working. However, the planes attacked the two boats, still mistaking them for Japanese gunboats. PT-346 did not respond defensively until it was too late, and it took heavy casualties. The skipper of PT-347, Lieutenant Williams, who had experienced the earlier attack, ordered his men into the water to stay dispersed, but two men were killed in the water and three wounded. PT-346 and PT-347 were completely destroyed by bombs, and the men were strafed in the water for approximately 1 hour, continuing to dive under the water to survive as the planes approached. Can you imagine when this is happening to be in the water? Harry by this time is gone from the scene, thankfully for him, otherwise he probably wouldn't be with us. But these men are hiding from their own planes in the water and getting shot at for an entire hour. Here's maybe a tiny bit of a silver lining in this tragic incident of friendly fire from World War II. Heroes of the day included Wilbur Larson, Motor Machinist Mate 3rd Class of PT-347, who received the Navy Marine Corps Medal for saving wounded non-swimmer Forrest May's life. So one of the sailors couldn't swim. This gentleman saved his life. And another hero, Lieutenant James Burke. Mortally wounded, Burke ordered medic John Furkovich to take his life jacket so Furkovich could survive and treat the wounded. And that sailor, the medic, John Furkovich, his daughter-in-law, Joe Furkovich, has now written a book about this incident. So sorry for that long monologue, but I thought that description might give us a sense of the big picture to add a little perspective to that firsthand account we heard from Harry. And now back to the way Harry Nicholas experienced all of this and the aftermath of it. To get back on that same boat, and you guys called it the Swifty 50 because it was PT-350?
The Shifty 50.
The Shifty 50. Must have been those V-12s, huh?
Yeah.
Was it at all strange to get back on that same boat after you had seen it shot up the way it had been?
No, it was the same stuff, yeah. Uh-huh.
How often did you guys go out on patrol like that?
Well, maybe 2 weeks we'd go out on patrol at night. It was always nighttime patrol, yeah.
And it seems to me, you're going out at night for a reason, but it seems to me that would be a lot more nerve-wracking to be out there at night when there's so little you can see. Did you feel tense on that boat waiting for something to happen?
No, not really. There was what we encouraged, saw there was they had barges at night. They were going from one island to the other. The Japanese were. Yeah. That's the way they couldn't do it during the day. It was nighttime. So we patrolled at night. Always. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And do you remember some of those patrols where you encountered enemy ships?
Yeah, we were on our way back to our tender. It was daylight already, and we saw one out there. We went by it, and they started shooting at us with carbines. So we shot them, and we got two survivors came aboard the boat. We made them take their clothes off, and I said, "You Bakatari," and that means in Japanese, means you're crazy. And they said, "Oh, Tojo no good, Clark Gable good," and they were going. And the officer said, "What'd you tell us?" I told him you were crazy.
They were Clark Gable fans, huh? So you took them prisoner and took them back to your ship?
We gave them to the Marines, yeah. I don't know what happened to them. But
yeah. Do you guys ever fire those four torpedoes on your boat?
No, we never did use them, no.
Which is probably a good thing, because you would have been in a stickier situation had you done that.
Ours were the type that the Mark III, they just fell off the side and they would take off, you know.
Right, right.
But the earlier ones where they shoot them out of a tube, the ones we had were the Mark Trees. They just laid them over on the side and they took off.
There's a famous movie made during World War II about PT boats with John Wayne in it. Do you remember the title of that film?
No, I don't remember what it was. They were expendable or something?
They were expendable.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I saw that.
I would think that wouldn't make you feel very good, that you were expendable.
You make me laugh.
Did you feel like you guys were expendable because you're in such a small boat and you're so, you know, you're out there as one of the first lines of defense here? Did you feel like you were expendable?
Actually, I didn't even know what expendable meant.
That was a good thing.
Yeah.
Looking back now, and we're going to talk about some of your other experiences, but do you ever look back at everything that you went through and say, man, it's pretty amazing that I survived all that?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
What aspect of that do you think is the most remarkable? Was there a situation that you felt was your closest call?
Well, yeah, but I feel like, well, maybe it was just happened to be, and I was at the right place at the right time, and things worked out. You know, I learned being in the service is being on time, taking orders, and living with people. That's what I learned. Mm-hmm. You really do.
And were all these rowdy young Navy boys good to live with?
No, they were all pretty good guys.
Yeah. Never got yourself into any trouble?
No, never did, no. We were small. It was only 11 men. We just did our thing.
What else can you tell us about PT boats and what it was like?
12 boats in a squadron, and they were all made alike. The whole thing, we had our own parts for everything, and we repaired them ourselves what we could and kept them going.
And it sounds like one of your main duties was to make sure that engine kept running, huh?
Yes. They had V-12 Packard engines, 1,500 horsepower. Real noisy down there. Oh, you couldn't hear nothing. And you had to be on duty in the engine room at all times. Somebody had to be there. And to put the boats in gear, you had to do it manually. Somebody's down there. The officer on the deck, they had to do that.
You had to wait for his order?
Yeah. You're just down there all the time.
So you spent a lot of time below deck?
Yes.
Do you think that was more difficult than being topside?
Oh, yeah. It was noisy down there. You get out, you couldn't hear nothing for a while. We had earplugs, but I don't think they helped.
besides that friendly fire incident that we talked about, there's a book that's been written about that recently called Enemy in the Mirror, and I'll put a link to that on our website at kmjnow.com. Besides that friendly fire incident, were there other situations where you guys were fired upon or felt like you were in danger?
No, not us, no. But other boats were, yeah.
And was it, you mentioned that day you guys were coming to help the other boat that got stuck on the reef. And I've read that that was pretty common for boats to get stuck on reefs there because you guys didn't know where the reefs were.
No, that's right.
Did that ever happen to your boat?
No.
You must have had a good skipper there, huh?
I guess they must have had everything all sketched out over there. I don't know.
So when was it that you came home from PT boats and then they reassigned you to the minesweeper?
That was 1945.
Why did you get transferred out of the PT squadron?
Well, I came back to the States to go to advanced diesel school, okay. Corporation Ignition. And when I got back here to the States, they reclassified it. It was three guys I was with, and they sent me to San Diego to repair base there. And I was there, and then from there, they put me on a repair ship, mm-hmm. heading to Hawaii and Shanghai. And from there, I got there, and then they put me on a YMS yarn minesweeper, mm-hmm. sweeping mines out of Formosa in Taiwan area. I fell down, I broke my zygoma here, and they put me on a repose, a hospital ship. And from there, I came back to the state on a St. Paul, to San Pedro, California, in February of 46, and I got out of service, mm-hmm. came home.
I bet your wife was glad to see you.
Oh, yes.
Well, how'd you fall? And you said you broke a bone under your eye there?
Yeah, zygoma here, right here.
Yeah, right under your left eye. What? How did that happen?
I must have slipped or something. I don't know what happened. I wasn't drunk.
We'll take your word for it. I'm backtracking here, but when you were sent back to the States for that advanced diesel school, was it hard to leave those other PT boat guys? Was that difficult to part ways with them?
Yes, it was, yeah. Uh-huh. But I just did what they told us to do, and that's all.
And then on that minesweeper, was that pretty routine duty? Did you guys have some excitement there?
Well, it was an old ship, old YMS. It was a wooden hull. Only, I think it went about 5 knots. It was slow.
Compared to a PT boat, I mean, this is a sloth or a snail, huh? Do you remember where you were when the Japanese surrendered and how you found out about that?
I was in San Diego then.
Was there a little celebration?
Yeah, it was. I was in San Diego, right? Man, we heard about it. Everybody was kissing each other, uh-huh. hugging each other. Then they sent me back overseas after that.
So all that minesweeper duty was cleanup after the war was over.
Yeah, that's what it was, yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, and I've noticed here, just looking around your house a little bit, well, you've got a PT boat belt buckle that you wear at the farmer's market sometimes. You've got a stained glass PT boat on the wall. You've got a model of President Kennedy's PT-109. It seems like you're proud that you were a PT boat man.
Yes, I am.
Why is that? What makes you proud?
Oh, I don't know. I think we were one of the top boats that they needed.
Yeah.
They sold all the boats. They got rid of them in the Philippines after the war. Mm-hmm. I think Korea bought some of them. The rest of them, they just sunk them.
You mentioned being at the museum in Fall River, Massachusetts, where they still have a couple of them. What was that like to see one of these old boats again?
Good. My two daughters and the son went back to see it. They were glad to see that, yeah.
You said you spent most of your time below deck. How rocky was that? Because you're in a pretty small boat, and sometimes you guys would be moving pretty fast. What did that feel like to experience that below deck?
You kept your legs straight. You hit some rough seas, it was bad. Yeah. And then sometimes we'd have a log, we'd hit a log and it hit our struts and the screws and we'd mess it all up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because sometimes the logs are just submerged a little bit and you couldn't see them out there in the Pacific.
So did you have some pretty tricky repair situations?
Yeah, we hit one time and it bent the strut. We were in dry dock for a while.
Yeah.
Got that fixed. It real cleaned and smoothed underneath, and we'd skip over the water real fast.
Yeah.
Always two boats went on patrol together.
What was your top speed in one of those?
Oh, maybe 40 knots at top over there. That's about all, yeah. Had 3,000 gallons of fuel, but we held 100 octane fuel. But we would go out about 200 miles for for patrol sometimes. On the way back, we were light, so we'd race coming back. One followed the other one to get in our wake, and the officer would go fast and pass him up, and then he'd pass you up.
Because you weren't weighed down by all that fuel anymore. Well, that's what I was going to ask you. If you took a PT boat out here to Pine Flat Lake down the road, could you water ski with it?
No.
Not fast enough?
Oh, it's plenty fast. About to be a big wake out there.
The rest of the people on the lake wouldn't like it too much, huh?
I don't think so.
No, I don't think we have to worry about a PT boat on Pine Flat Lake. But you should keep an eye out for this 90-year-old farmer and his great produce, and keep your ear open, both of them, for the rest of Harry's story when Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ. Hey, Bulldog fans, Paul Leffler here, coming to you not as the voice of the dogs, but as a husband and father of two. Ever have a hard time finding a restaurant that's family-friendly, won't set you back a week's pay, and has the kind of food that makes you want to keep coming back? I think I found it. And no, it's not one of those chains. It's one of a kind. Luna's Pizzeria, an Italian restaurant on Pulaski Avenue in Old Town Clovis. The Liberta family's been serving up great, authentic Italian food in the heart of cowboy country for more than 40 years. The pizza dough is made from scratch daily, and so is the bread. You won't forget the bread. I'm a sucker for that bread and the meatballs and the ravioli. And hey, did I say family friendly? How do you top a kid's menu with nothing over $3.95, drink included? I'm not making that up. See for yourself at lunasclovis.com. And while you're there, check out the family meal deals. That's lunasclovis.com or 299-4141. Tell them I sent you. And if you really want to, bring me back some bread. Luna's Pizzeria and Italian Restaurant. You'll love it at Luna's.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes on this first Saturday of May. Our guest today is a Navy veteran of World War II and a farmer who just keeps going and going, 90 years old and still making two round trips a week to sell his kiwis. I've tasted those kiwis. They're delicious. His grapes, his Cara oranges, you name it. He does that at farmers markets in Southern California every week. We have lots of farmers with a lot of grapevines here in the valley, whether they're raisin growers or vintners, or maybe they're just growing table grapes. But I don't know if any of them can claim what Harry Nicholas can. Right in his driveway, next to the sign that tells you you're on the Nicholas farm, Harry has a grape tree, not a vine, a tree. I have a picture of it on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And maybe if you can catch up to Harry sometime, you can have him explain that one to you. If I end up with a little time at the end of the program today, I'm hoping I can talk to you a little bit about Honor Flight, the awesome nationwide program that is going to be coming to the Central Valley very, very soon. And there were some other flights this last week. I really want to make sure I take the time to commend Willowwood USA and its Central California Dream Flight Tour. Whether it was Porterville, Corcoran, Fresno, or one of the other stops, a total of 41 aging veterans got to go up for a little joyride in a vintage 1942 Stearman biplane, thanks to a group called Ageless Aviation Dreams. What a treat. And that's another great program I'm sure will be back around next year. Harry Nicholas has been around for 90 years, and he still has that enthusiasm and energy, which I'm sure you've heard jump right through your radio today. Let's get back to Harry's story now. When you think about World War II, I know it's been a long time, and most of the people alive today weren't alive then. They don't know what World War II was all about. What do you think we need to remember today? What's important for us to know?
Well, that war was a war that we had to be in. These other things are, I can't figure it out. They're just protecting somebody else or what they're, I don't know what's coming on, but that war was a war we had to be in. This other stuff is nothing but I can't figure it out.
Is there one thing that, with regard to your service in the war, that you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Oh, I'm thankful. I'm home here and healthy, and my mind is clear.
How often do you think about that day, the April 29th?
Oh, not very much. Right now, I'm talking to you, and it gets me back memories of what happened I had forgot about, but...
Yeah. And I don't want to, you know, stick you in that spot, but I think everybody out there listening is thinking, what in the world would I do in a situation like that? And what would that feel like? I mean, was there a bit of panic going on your boat in that situation?
No. I think we just did our job and everything was okay. We didn't regret nothing. We just did our job.
Well, and I guess, too, one of the things I heard is that part of the communication struggles there were you had MacArthur's area and Nimitz's area, and you were kind of guys got stuck in no man's land between those two or something?
Probably that's what happened, yeah.
What were your living conditions like when you weren't out on the boat?
That was good, yeah. We had good meals and showers. They'd take a shower on the shore. We slept on the boat. We had a base for us also, you know. Then we had a ship was our communication. That's where all our supplies were on that.
So you were well-fed?
Well-fed, yes.
Was there so here you are a farmer, and you're famous for your great produce that you've been taking to this farmer's market forever. Did you taste anything in the tropics there that you still remember today?
Well, the pine cones, I mean, the coconuts. Uh-huh. We used to have the little native kids climb the trees and get the coconut, and we'd take juice out of that. We'd drink that, maybe put a little bit of vodka with it.
And I guess you can't really grow coconuts here in Orange Cove, huh?
No. There was, back there, there was, on. You look on the shore, and you see rows of palm trees there planted. I guess years ago, they raised orchards of them up there.
And you said you'd had the native kids go up and get them. You never thought about climbing the tree yourself?
God, their legs, you don't see their, them kids there. Their toes were like a claw, you know.
Curled around the tree trunk, huh?
We throw quarters in the water and then go way down to pick them up, get them.
Give us a sense of these areas that you were in, where you interacted with the native people wherever you were. What were these locations?
In Robal area, around in New Guinea, New Britain area.
And did you feel like you knew you were fighting for your country and your country had been attacked? Did you feel like you were fighting for these people, too, and their freedom?
I didn't realize none of that, no. Yeah. I just figured we were trying to beat the Japanese, that's all, they were after.
How did you feel about the Japanese?
Well, they were human people. They just, their leaders tell them what to do, what they're human beings like we are. I don't think they wanted that. They had to do what they told them to do.
Well, and I'm curious here, too, before the war, had you had friends here on the east side of the valley that were Japanese Americans?
Yes. Uh-huh. My neighbors were all Japanese here.
You were still here when President Roosevelt issued the executive order in 1942 to ship them all to internment camps. Was that hard to see these people taken off?
Really, yeah. The first thing they did, they took them off the coast, brought them inland here for about 4 or 5 months. Then they sent them all out of here.
And some of these people were your friends?
Yes, they were, yeah. But it was a thing that had happened. You never know. Maybe if we didn't do that, we wouldn't have won the war. You never know.
Right.
You know what I mean?
But I imagine for you, because, I mean, here are these families, and they're immigrants from Japan. Your parents came from Lebanon. What's to stop the government from putting all the Lebanese people in a camp, right?
I'll tell them to go to hell.
And since you've been here, you're still on the ranch where you were born. I imagine after the war, you saw some of those Japanese American families come back, right?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Was that something that was you felt good to see that happen to them after they had been treated the way they were?
Yeah, a lot of the guys that went to school, they all went in the American army too, you know.
Yeah.
But their parents were in the concentration camp.
Do you think you could have done that if your parents were in a camp, go out and fight for the country that's holding them hostage?
Not after, yeah. At the time, things happened. You know, now it's different.
Well, how long are you going to keep doing this with the farmer's market?
As long as I'm healthy enough, I can drive yet and see. I enjoy what I do. Even if it takes me 2 hours longer, I'll do it.
I'm sure over the years you've encountered a lot of other people that want to get into agriculture. What advice do you give them? What's been key to your success as a farmer?
Well, I plant things that I feel like are good. If the fruit's not any good, I won't plant it. In other words, they come out with some new varieties and they look good, but they don't taste as good as the old varieties are. Mm-hmm. And so I kept some of the old varieties and I take them to the market. They want to know why other people don't. I said, well, I just kept those old varieties I thought were good.
Well, that sounds like that takes a lot of personal attention and care. You got to go out and taste stuff to know what's good.
Right, uh-huh.
Do you have a favorite tree or vine or plant that you have kept going for all these years?
Well, I got the ruby grapes. That's an old variety, and it's the freezers used to buy that for the cocktails, and they used to buy that a lot. Finally, they quit planting because the new varieties came out, but I kept them. And now I sell to the Santa Monica Malibu School District. For 14 years, they've been buying for me for the school lunches. They started that down there, and a lot of the other schools are doing that now.
If somebody's listening and they want to come meet you somewhere and buy some of your produce, do they have to go all the way to L.A. to do it?
No, they can come here to my farm.
Yeah?
They can pick them off the vines. They got a new variety there, Tomcord. It's between a Thompson and a Concord grape.
Right.
It's a good grape. I love it. The people like it. No seed in it.
Yeah, I'm a fan of the Tomcords. What's your secret to staying so young and fit at 90?
Eat a lot of fruit.
Yeah.
And I got drunk a couple of times when I was in Panama, and I didn't know what I did. I said, I ain't going to do this no more. So I never drank after that.
Yet another lesson learned in the Navy. And if you want to see a picture of Harry in his Navy uniform, you can go to kmjnow.com. Harry, thank you for serving our country in World War II. I like that advice. Eat a lot of fruit. And you've been helping people do that here in the San Joaquin Valley and beyond for decades now. Don't stop. One thing we didn't get into, but I think you at home will get a kick out of if you enjoyed listening to Harry Nicholas today. You'll enjoy the giant 90th birthday card that was given to him at the farmer's market down in Southern California. I do have a photo of that at kmjnow.com and on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. You know, a couple of the other pages I follow on Facebook are Honor Flight and Kern County Honor Flight. That's the national organization and a hub based in Bakersfield. The folks in Bakersfield and Kern County have been terrific. They have taken a lot of our local vets from the Fresno Clovis area on some of their trips already. But now some great people right in the Fresno Clovis area have gotten together, and this will soon be another hub for that special nonprofit organization, Honor Flight. The idea is to fly World War II veterans to Washington, D.C. to see their memorial, because most World War II veterans never have had that opportunity. So this is our opportunity, our chance to do something really meaningful for those who have done so much for us. If you're one of those people who listen regularly to Hometown Heroes, I know I don't really need to sell you on this idea. You get it. And maybe you want to go to honorflight.org. That's honorflight.org. You could do a little homework on the organization before we officially launch the local hub. Some of you have already contacted me about it because I mentioned it just a bit, and I hope a lot more of you will do that, because this really is an all-hands-on-deck situation. We're bringing people together from the political realm, both sides of the aisle, the educational realm, the media side, most importantly, all the great veterans groups in this area. We hope they'll be involved, and there's no reason that we can't bring the whole Central Valley together to make this as special as it can possibly be for these veterans while they're still here to experience something like this. So if you have some ideas on how we can make Honor Flight even more meaningful for these veterans, paul@kmjnow.com. That's my email address, real simple, paul@kmjnow.com. So let me know. There are going to be so many different ways to participate in this. And if this idea tugs at your heart, I want you involved in Central Valley Honor Flight. So thanks for your patience. Stay tuned for more info once it's all official. This much I know, no matter where your hometown is in our great Central Valley, for me it's Los Banos, where the great May Day Fair is going on this weekend, but no matter where your hometown is, there are heroes in your hometown who put their lives on the line for our freedom, and we can thank them in a way that they'll never forget through Central Valley Honor Flight. So let's make it a valley-wide effort, and let's show the rest of the country how much we value here in the Central Valley the service and sacrifice displayed by our greatest generation. Can you tell I'm a little fired up about it? I hope you are too. And I hope you join us again next Saturday for another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.